I think you probably understand, you know, I don't have a talk prepared. So we'll see if one appears or not. If there's a talk prepared, then you can present it. But
I've heard this one before.
You have, huh? Yeah. That's amazing, since this is the first time it's been given. I've only done a couple of these classes, but my partner Margo's been studying something called, now I can't remember what it's called. It's some kind of listening. And you go to the class, and there's like 8 people. And one by one, somebody gets up in front, and you have 2 turns. The first turn, you talk for like 3 minutes or 4 minutes, and then the second turn, you talk for 7 minutes. And after you finish your, and during your talk, you're to make eye contact with somebody in the room at all times. So I'm practicing this with you tonight, just so you know, practicing. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. There's one person who is a little out of eye contact here. But we'll manage. So it's pretty interesting because I'm not so used to making eye contact with people. And more customarily, if I'm trying to think of something to say, I kind of like, I kind of look around for it. And I look down. I don't like, where, you know, help me out. I tend to like, but so tonight I'm going to be practicing whatever this is called, compassionate listening or something. Anyway, after you've done your talk, you know, you say thank you very much, then everybody in the room, all the people who've been listening, are to say, each of them says 2 words. And are not allowed to say anything about what you talked about, only about your true nature, only about your core, your essence, your spirit. You know, bright angel, you know, hungry tiger, or whatever. So you get to say, each person says 2 words, and then you say thank you each time somebody says their 2 words. So it's pretty interesting. And if you want, you can stand up in front of everybody and just look people in the eye. Before you start, you make eye contact with each person. And then during the talk, if you're not talking, you just make eye contact with somebody for your 3 minutes or 7 minutes, you know. And then people still have to say something about your spirit, your core, your essence. It's very interesting. We don't usually listen to one another this way. We get very involved in that's right, that's wrong, what they're saying, it's interesting, it's not interesting, who cares? when will I get a chance to talk? You know, we have we're very busy. So excuse me, I'll try this out tonight with, you know, while we... This won't be the first time, so don't worry, but, you know. But you know, if I'm not talking for a little bit, I'm letting something, I'm waiting for the next thing to come through from beyond, or wherever that is that it comes through from. Where does it come from? So one thing I wanted to talk about tonight, which I've been thinking about this weekend, and you know, I did a one day sitting on Saturday with the SBMG group, and then I did a sitting and lecture last night with SBMG. So some of you might have been to some part of that. And so tonight I thought I'd aim what I'm talking about a little more to, you know, a Zen audience. So I thought I'd use a little bit more Zen stories, but coincidentally I used one Zen story over the weekend. One day, Basso was sitting Zazen, and his teacher, I think it was Nangaku, said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm practicing meditation." "Why are you practicing meditation?" And Basso said, I'm going to become a Buddha. I'm practicing meditation to become a Buddha." And Nangaku kind of nodded, And a while later he came back with a roofing tile and a cloth, and he was rubbing the roofing tile with his cloth. And Basso's like, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm polishing this tile." "Why are you polishing the tile?" "Well, I'm going to make it into a mirror." And of course Basso said, "Excuse me, but you can't make a roofing tile into a mirror by polishing it." And the teacher then responded, "And you can't become a Buddha by sitting." So we have this interesting kind of question, like, you know, why would we sit, or what are we doing? Or there was another teacher, of course, Yaku-san, who's when his teacher was it Sekito Kisen, who wrote that, what we just read. He was practicing meditation. Yaku-san was sitting, and the teacher said, "What are you doing?" And Yaku-san said, "I'm not doing anything." And the teacher said, "Well, if you're not doing anything, you're wasting your time." And Yaku-san alertly said, "No, if I was doing something, that would be a waste of time." And then the teacher said, "Tell me more about what it is you're not doing, about this not doing." And Yaku-san said, "Even 1,000 sages could not describe it." So far be it from me to tell you about not doing, if even 1,000 sages can't describe it. One thing I think about when I think about these stories is, you know, I'm using, and we were talking a little bit beforehand, one of the books I have is on becoming an alchemist, and one of the things she talks about in there is what she calls the horizontal world and the vertical world. And, you know, mostly we live in a horizontal world. You need to get from here to there, and you need to make a living, and it's all happening in the horizontal world. And then you think, well, maybe I can have a better experience, or I can live, you know, differently or better. It's horizontal. Maybe you could make more money. Maybe you could have a different job. Maybe your relationship could improve. And you have certain standards and certain ways to measure and certain expectations and certain assumptions. And then you assess, you know, how am I doing? And with meditation, you know, you ask somebody, "How's your meditation?" And they say, "Oh, great. I was so focused and clear. And I could follow my breath. It was wonderful." And then some other time, my meditation, I'm not so good. You know, I was my thinking was scattered. And I couldn't focus on my breathing, and my legs hurt." So these are all assessments in, you know, horizontal language, horizontal world. So where does the spiritual come in? Is there anything spiritual about this? You know, if you're going to become a Buddha, that's horizontal world. You know, like, I'm going to move up in the world. I'm going to become a Buddha. I won't just be this ordinary person that I've been. I will become a Buddha. I will gain standing, and I will become more spiritual, as described by my mind is quieter, or whatever my standards are. I will adopt some standards, and then I can work on my little project to improve my meditation. And this is all still a horizontal world. And the first Zen teacher says you can't become a Buddha by sitting. But he also could say, you know, who cares? You become a Buddha or you don't. You know, what difference does it make? You're still assessing, measuring, better, worse, comparing. I want to go here. I don't want to go there. And you're maneuvering in this horizontal world. And everything in the horizontal world is compared to something else. And now, of course, many people say one thing about the horizontal world that we live in these days is there's no center. The center is the spiritual. And they're culturally, and then there's no center to the culture anymore. You know, what's the government doing? What's at the center? It's a kind of travesty at the center. It's not, you know, I know some of you may have seen David Letterman interview Barack Obama. And you watch Barack Obama, and you're like, there's some presence there. There's some dignity. There's some grace. There's some charm. He had some presence. And that's gone now. And then, you know, even though he had something like that, you know, then, but the government is kind of like, oh, we're not sure we want to have health care for what? Have health care for people? Why would we do that? Figure it out for yourself. This is a free country. You shouldn't have to have insurance. Whatever, you know. So is there any fundamental value? And then we have, like, is it our kids important or guns, you know? So, what's at the center? So, in Zen, you know, it's fairly simple. You sit down and grow tall inside, and you sit right in the center. And then people say, you know, about Zen, well, we practice just sitting. Just sitting means just sitting in the center. Not comparing, this is better than that. My meditation is improving. I'm getting somewhere. I'm becoming more spiritual. I'm becoming calmer. I'm doing this. I'm getting over that. No, just sit in the center. And that center is without comparison to anything else. And it's what's called the vertical. And this is the world of spirit. And when in Zen, when the, you know, Suzuki Roshi's simple description of Zen is realize your true nature and express yourself fully. True nature is your core, your center. Are you? And then most of us are not exactly in our center. We're in the horizontal world. How do I take care of this and manage that and avoid this and get over that and, you know, shape up and straighten out and improve and, you know. And that's not the center. The center is, it's like this. Just this is, you know. There's many sayings and sayings about this. Mind itself is Buddha. And it doesn't say, you know, a particular kind of mind. It's just mind. mind itself is Buddha. Basso said that later. You know, that was important Soto Zen teaching for some time. And then when people started to repeat it, you know, the student would come and I hear you teach mind itself as Buddha, and then Basso would say, not mind, not Buddha. So most of us want to, we're really involved in this horizontal world. It's very difficult to say, fine, it's just like this, okay, and I'm going to sit, and I will bring my presence. So this is more like Suzuki Roshi saying, we sit to be ready for anything. It's not to become a Buddha, or become more spiritual, or more enlightened, or a better person, or, you know, to fulfill some picture we have of, you know, if I could just be this kind of person or that kind of person, then my life would, you know, things would change. I think, you know, if you're anything like me, you know, the idea is like, I don't think, you know, I've had, you know, all the love I've wanted. How am I going to have more love come into my life? I'm going to have to become a better person. And if I become this better person, then people will like me. People will appreciate me. I don't know about you, but it hasn't worked. Yesterday I told many stories about this last night. You know, I've taken a lot of communication classes, you know, Marshall Rosenberg. I've had classes with Marshall Rosenberg and nonviolent communication, and I did classes with Mudita Nisker and Dan Klerman, who have a calmoptions.com, and, you know, many different things. And, you know, one day I was talking to a woman on the phone, and I said something, and she said, you're such a terrible communicator. And I'm in my skillful communication mode, I think. And I say, well, you know, communication is very important to me. So if you could tell me what was problematic for you about my communication, I would be really interested to find out about that, and something I would know something to work on. And she said, you know what I'm talking about. I said, excuse me, but I don't know what you're talking about. And she didn't quite slam down the phone at that point, but the conversation didn't go anyplace. And here I've done this, I've done communication classes. I'm working on this. I'm willing to work on it more. I'm willing to learn something. If some of you were here last night, but I was so disoriented by this conversation. I came home later in the day, and somebody had been in my house and they left an empty ice cream container in my sink. And I discovered that the plants in the living room were overwatered. Damn, somebody has gotten into my house and they've eaten my ice cream and overwatered the plants in the living room. And I called my neighbor and she said, Ed, if that's the worst thing that happens when people get into your house, don't worry about it. But I said, no, but I am worried about it. I'm stressed. I'm like, what are people doing in my house? And she said, if you're really worried, you can have the locks changed. So I had the locks changed. It's about $50 a lock, three locks, new keys to the house. And then a day after that, I thought, maybe that was me. So, you know, we make all these efforts and it doesn't mean that, you know, people appreciate it or value you or, you know, even a good-hearted person, you know, stuff happens and some things work out and other things don't, and you're not in charge and how people see you. And the other thing about this is I finally realize, you know, it's up to you. And there's a saying in the Diamond Sutra, a bodhisattva should arouse a thought unsupported by anything, unsupported by sight, sound, smells, taste, touchables, or mind objects, unsupported by Dharma, unsupported by no Dharma, unsupported by anything. So one of those thoughts is, you are a beautiful, precious person, and you could go ahead and love yourself without any evidence from the world. That's one of those. There's no evidence. You can never get enough evidence that you are a good enough person to like. But you go ahead and love yourself anyway. I mean, if you choose to, not because you've got enough evidence finally, through your performance is good enough, and you've got enough acclaim. And at some point, you know, the acclaim dies down, and you're back home. And Patty was at Kripalu 15 years ago, she says. And there I was sitting and leading meditation for 300 people. You know, and a few days later I'm home and, you know, by myself in Inverness or someplace. And did, you know, so if I'm going to have some kind, compassionate regard for myself, warm heart for me, I'm going to have to just, okay, I'm going to start working on that. No evidence. And that's the vertical world. Because if you're just going to be in the horizontal world, you'll never, ever get enough evidence. I'm a precious person. Because there will always be somebody who's like, you're such a lousy communicator. You've got problems. You need help. I don't know, maybe your world is different than mine, but I doubt it. You see, that's where I look. So, in this vein, by the way, then there's another story, a Zen story, which I appreciate. I think it was Seppo, and Seppo is his Japanese name, and Ganto. They were close friends. And Seppo is famous because he went, you know, I think the story is he went to see Tozan 21 times or something. And Seppo was famous for being slow. So maybe you can relate to this. Oh, you mean there's other people in the history of Zen who maybe are as slow as I am? Wow. And they just kept on, you know, sitting in the vertical. Fast or slow, we don't know. Which is which. Anyway, one day, Seppo and Ganto were out on a pilgrimage. And it started snowing. And it was snowing apparently quite heavily. And they got to a little hut in the mountains where they could get in the hut and maybe they could have a fire, but they could be out of the snow anyway. And Ganto said, I'm gonna take a nap. How about you? And Seppo said, I'm going to sit. And Ganto said, why don't you get some rest? No, my heart is not yet at ease. I'm going to sit. And Seppo's there sitting, and Ganto's there napping. And after a couple of hours, Ganto wakes up and says, are you still sitting? You know, it's snowing, and we've got a lot of walking ahead. You know, you could use some rest. You could really, you know, use a nap. Get some rest. And Seppo's saying, no, I need to keep sitting. So, and again he says, you know, my heart is not at ease. So then Ganta says, you know, well, okay, all right. Let's talk. Tell me about it. Tell me about your experience in Zen. And tell me what you've come to understand and, you know, who you studied with and what you, you know, how you see things. So Seppo goes into this, regales Ganta with this litany or, you know, saga. I studied with Tozan 21 times and, you know, and I heard about the teaching of non-sentient beings, you know, speaking the Dharma and so on, you know, whatever it was. And after whatever it is, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, Ganta says, That's all. Stories and information that could come in the side door. In the back door. The real teaching is what flows forth from your heart. And Seppo goes, and his heart starts going out. He didn't know. He'd been accumulating information and stories and teachings, and, you know, he was going to become a better student. And Ganta said, no, the real teaching is what bursts forth from your chest. And on one hand, that's very reassuring. Huh? That you being you is pretty awesome. And you expressing your truth and your heart and sharing your heart with the world. Wow. That's the real teaching, Ganta said. It's like I listened to all these Michael Mead lectures and talks and things from his site, which is Mosaic, and also from Sounds True, Sounds True, which I'm now a Sounds True author. You know, my new book, No Recipes, is coming out. It's published by Sound True May 1st. So, but Michael Mead, I've heard him say now several times, you know, education is to lead out. When you become educated, you, your genius, your heart is, you know, your calling, your you, what you have to share and offer is being led out. Instruction is where they cram it in. So are you busy receiving instruction, or are you busy, you know, with education? Busy filling yourself up with teaching? Or letting what's in your heart come out. You know, you let it burst forth. So this is also, who was it who said? I'll think of it in a moment. I may have to look away here. But maybe if I look into your face, you will tell me who it is that I'm trying to remember the story of. Well, we'll have to let it go. It will, you know, perhaps come back later. Oh, I remember. It's another very famous story. Wang Bo said one day to the assembly, all of you gobblers of dregs, if you keep on like this, when will you have today? Gobblers of dregs, you know, the dregs is, you know, I make some coffee and then, you know, I have my life experience. Here, you want some dregs? And they, oh, some good dregs, wonderful. Oh, and so he called his students gobblers of dregs, you know. You keep taking in all of this information, all of this teaching, you know, and you're accumulating, you're acquiring these dregs of other people's lives. If you keep on like this, when will you have today? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, meeting this moment. Without some idea of how it's not good enough, it's not right, it should be different, I don't like it, whatever you do with the moment. Awesome moment. And then he said, all of you gobblers of dregs, if you keep on like this, when you have today, haven't you heard? There are no teachers of Zen in all of China. And then a monk comes forward and says, teacher, there's hundreds of monasteries and thousands of monks. How can you say there are no teachers of Zen? And Wang Bo said, I didn't say there was no Zen. I said there are no teachers of Zen. So you could also say, you know, hey, you be the teacher. What's in your heart? What do you have to bring to the world? And we keep thinking, you know, the most common problem we have is, oh, but my, what I have in my heart is not good enough. People will not receive it well. So I better just share what is acceptable and, you know, what is ordinary. I better not offer anything too unusual that people might say you're such a bad communicator. Or maybe I better just keep my mouth shut when it comes to my heart. So anyway, it's what some people call, you know, being vulnerable. There's an extraordinary, I found, set of six CDs by Brené Brown. I think that sounds true, too. Brené Brown is from Texas, and she says the motto in Texas growing up was lock and load. And very interesting person because she... You know, she's very smart and then very facile with her language and very funny. She talks about coming home from a date with her husband. And, you know, they've gotten a babysitter and it's a date night. And, you know, and they're coming back and they've had this wonderful evening. And then they get out of the car and they start walking up towards the house. And there's hedges there. And she says, oh, what if there's some... hooligans there. They're right there on the other side of the hedges and they've got guns and they're going to attack us and we could be shot dead any minute now. And the poor kids. Oh my God, this is such a tragedy. And he says, and the husband says, I guess date night is over, huh? But she's very funny. But this set of six CDs, it's the power of vulnerability. And what happened was, she goes through school and she says, I wasn't interested in, you know, like trying to communicate with people, so I thought I'd become a researcher. I was interested in psychology, so then I started doing research and I got a PhD and, you know, it wasn't about talking to people. It was about getting information. So then she says, you know, she got into her 30s and then she started doing research on people who were wholesome. And how is it that some people are wholesome and positive and other people aren't? And is this something you can learn? And then she found out that wholesome people shared a lot of the same characteristics. And basically she found out that they'd each figured out for themselves what they needed to do to become more wholesome. And to be more positive. And at some point she started thinking, like, you know what? I see these people, they're such awesome people, you know, I think maybe I need a spiritual life. First she thought, maybe I could use some therapy, and she went to the therapist with 3 pages, legal-sized paper of her agenda for the therapy, and she read them off to the therapist, and she said, can we do this? And the therapist said, sure, and Brene Brown says, you know, I've got about 4 months for this. Is that okay? And of course the therapist says, what do you think? But at some point she decided, I need a spiritual life. So she started studying, and you know, through her church and with various people and so on. Very interesting. So we get to this point where it's not enough to just have the information. We want to have our own connection. Vertical. We want our own connection with Source, with Earth, you know, up and down. And it's about, and you know, in the Zen world, you know, I love that expression, you know, when will you have today? Because it reminds me of, again, one of my old stories, but when I made biscuits at Tassajara and they didn't come out right, and I thought, well, I'll make them without the milk, and they still didn't come out right, and without the eggs, and they didn't come out right, and with Crisco instead of butter, and they didn't come out right. And then after the fourth or fifth failure, I thought, right compared to what? Oh my God, this is not Pillsbury or Bisquick biscuits that I'd grown up with. Why would I be trying to make my biscuits taste like something from my childhood? But our pictures of the kind of person to become are also from our childhood. You know, I want to be kind, I want to be friendly, I want to be this, and, you know, and often those pictures are limited by, you know, what we grew up with. I mean, you know, classically, you know, people sometimes will say, well, I wouldn't want to say anything that would upset you. Because, well, where do we get that? Some of us had some pretty, you know, difficult parents. And you didn't want to upset them. So this is the way, so you learn to behave. Like, no, I'm not going to say anything that would upset anybody. But then just to be on the safe side, you know, pretty soon you're not saying hardly anything. What about, and then what happens to your heart? And letting something come forth. So you not only can't say anything that's going to upset anybody, you can't say anything that's going to connect with their heart. So at some point, you know, my new book, by the way, is called No Recipe. So at some point, let go of the recipe that you've been trying to make, the biscuits from your childhood, that become the person from your childhood. Let go of the recipe and taste the biscuits of today. Be the person you could be today. There are no teachers of Zen in all of China. I didn't say there was no Zen. I just said there were no teachers of Zen. Who, if there are no teachers, who are you going to learn this from? This Zen business? Okay, one more story. And we'll call it an evening. I mean, after all, we have a birthday party to get to. You know, I was very fortunate to meet Suzuki Roshi. Today, I was doing an interview for something, a blog or something called The Salt. They have 240,000 individual, you know, viewers per month. It's something that NPR puts out. And I did an email interview. And they said, you know, years before mindfulness became popular, you were already, you know, doing this. What happened? And I said, well, it was the 60s. And I dropped out of school, you know, turn on, drop out, turn on, tune in. I didn't do the turning on part, but I did the dropping out and the tuning in part. And I met, was fortunate to meet Suzuki Roshi. Anyway, one day, you know, during sesshins, he would often, I think it was the fifth morning, second period of meditation, the fifth day, and he would start talking during zazen, which otherwise he didn't do. And he said, some of you think that I'm the teacher and you're the student. That's a mistake. Some of you think I'm going to tell you things that you don't know so that you understand. That's wrong thinking. And I thought, oh my God. If you're not the teacher, if it's up to me, what are we going to do? But, you know, you have to start someplace. Maybe it never occurred to you to be the teacher, you know. Anyway, and then he went on. Sometimes the teacher bows to the student. Sometimes the student bows to the teacher. Sometimes the teacher is the student. Sometimes the student is the teacher. The student and the teacher are practicing together. And he went on like this. And then I recall it being at the San Francisco Zen Center before the floor was put into the Zendo, when there was still black and white linoleum tiles from the old, whatever it was called, you know, it used to be a Jewish home for Jewish women. Anyway, but he leapt up from his seat, you know, with his little stick, and he went over to the person at the beginning of the row, and he called out, who is the teacher? And then, you know, stick on the shoulder, and then person bows, and he went, pap, pap! And then the second person, who is the student? Bap, bap. Who is the teacher? Bap, bap. Who is the student? Bap, bap. And then after the fourth or fifth person, he ran out of breath and just hit everybody after that and stopped asking who is the teacher, who is the student. So, you know, some, you know, as far as that goes, sometimes we're the teacher, sometimes we're the student, but to sit in the vertical world means, you know, you're the teacher, you're the student. We can't tell. The teacher is your, you know, Katagiri Roshi. One time, somebody said, Katagiri Roshi, what do we do when there's no teacher around? You know, it was in the aftermath when Richard Baker had been ousted. And I was the head resident teacher at Green Gulch. But as far as this person was concerned, there was no teacher around. Case in point, another case in point. What do we do when there's no teacher around? And Katagiri Roshi said, then keep a warm spot in your heart for the teaching. You keep a warm spot here if you know the teacher's not flowing out. Well, you keep a warm spot here for teaching to come out, teaching to come forth. You know what? I didn't turn on my tape recorder, so I'm going to have to get it from you.
It's easy to get.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go to our website.
Okay. Okay. What's your website these days? Valley Streams?
Yeah. We can send you the link.
Oh, you can send the link? Oh, please. I try to just get it for myself so I don't have to. But thank you. I'm so glad. Thank you. This has been not bad talk. People ask me about my food, you know, and I teach cooking in Zen in Germany and Austria and Switzerland. And then, so how's the food? And I say, nicht schlecht, which is not bad. So, Dharma talk, not bad. How is the Dharma talk? Not bad. Who knows? So, okay, thank you very much. It's now your turn. Each of you gets to say two words about the spirit of the gentleman giving the talk tonight. we can either stop early and cakeify, or you know, you could ask a question or two. All of you gobblers of dregs.
Let them eat cake.
Let them eat cake. Yeah, that's another story, of course. But I forgot the question, you know. Do you remember the question? You know, what is the teaching beyond the Buddhas and ancestors that have never been expressed, never been taught before? And Yun Man or somebody said, cake. Yeah, or some translations say sesame cake, but you know, but cake. So we get to enjoy tonight the teaching beyond anything the Buddhas and ancestors have ever expressed. Oh, you have the microphone.
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
How do you keep the vertical and the horizontal going at the same time? Like,
yeah, that's called practice. That's why, you know, Dogen says, you know, practice is enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
The practice of having the vertical going with the horizontal is.
Mm-hmm.
Enlightenment. That's
okay.
What he says. You
okay.
know, so your you know, the spiritual world can arise in any place at any time, but it's up to each of us to find a way to bring that the spiritual world into this world. That's practice. And you know, and we do different things, you know, you know, I worked in the bakery at Gringotts that Mick Sopko does. And, you know, when you start work, there's an altar. And there's some words by Suzuki Roshi that say, you practice, and then, you know, eventually the bread comes out. You are a good loaf of bread. And you should know how to make a good loaf of bread. And so they bow and offer incense, and they chant, and he's got a sheaf of wheat or something that's from his grandmother in Slovakia, and he's got all these objects to, you know, represent the sacred and remind what is that spirit to bring that we want to bring to the work today. And then we chant, you know, can we bring that spirit into this work today? And then we make offerings, and the spirit of an offering is, you know, I didn't understand for about 20 years. I used to think this is so stupid to be serving doll food to the Buddha. What's that about? I have important things to do to get this meal ready. I don't have time to make food and little dishes. But I realized eventually that, you know, you cook the food, you put it on the Buddha tray, and you, big drum roll, and you offer it to the Buddha, and then you bow, and you turn, you walk away. You don't care what they think, what the Buddha thinks. The Buddha's not going to tell you anything anyway, but even if the people tell you something, you did your part. Your part isn't whether, you know, what, there's nothing to do with how they receive it. Very little anyway, you know. Some people like it, some people don't, you know, some people appreciate you, some people don't, any particular offering you have. So, but it's your offering, so that's the spirit of the offering is you, this is my offering. Bye now. So it is nice when somebody says, thank you for your effort, you know. But you're studying exactly how to do that, and that's Zen. You know, that's Dogen says practice and enlightenment are one. Suzuki Roshi says practice and enlightenment are one, and it's practicing having this spirit and bringing it into the and, you know, and there's different teachings for that. You know, Suzuki Roshi told me, when you wash the rice, wash the rice. When you cut the carrots, cut the carrots. When you stir the soup, stir the soup. Is it okay if I use salt? They tell me that salt is poisonous, and we don't use salt here at Tassajara. And Suzuki Roshi said, you're the cook. You do what you want. And you bring as much spirit as you can to each activity in your life. And some were ready to bring spirit to, and others were, you know, it's so challenging. We talked about that last night, the Home Depot. To bring spirit to the Home Depot? Holy mackerel, that's a challenge. I can't even bring spirit to the United Market, let alone the Home Depot, you know. And it's not a reflection on you or me that we're not capable of it. It's just like, wow, that's challenging to bring the spiritual world into the horizontal world. But we find places to do it. We have a garden, or we get some flowers for our partner and put it there, and we offer some flowers to somebody. Or we say, how nice to see you. and our heart is in it, you know. So we're studying how to do that. Yes, sir.
Yes, I can appreciate the presence of Suzuki Roshi. Shinryu Suzuki.
Yeah, Shinryu Suzuki.
I wanted to ask you, what impressed you the most from being in his presence?
Yeah. I felt seen. I felt met. It happens so rarely. And I felt, and from the first time we bowed, and I felt completely received and completely unjudged, completely seen, and no problem about who I was. And many, many people had that experience with him. And, you know, mostly when we meet people, they're like, who do you think you are? All kinds of different things. And do you like me? I'm scared of you. You know, people are, and he's just impassive. But not the kind of impassive where you weren't met. Not stone-faced, but just not reacting to, oh yeah, you're a great person. I, you know, can appreciate who you are. No, it's not, just met. Very simple, very clean. And he did that day in and day out. I told the story last night of my friend David Chadwick, who now has a website, cuke.com, which is because Suzuki Roshi was known as Crooked Cucumber, and that was the title of David's biography of Suzuki Roshi. And David had what some people thought of as a bad habit of drinking wine with the guests at dinner, and then after helping with cleanup would stay up late at night with the guests drinking alcohol, which is against the rules of Tazara. And then he'd miss meditation in the morning, miss the bowing and chanting, miss the study, miss the breakfast, and then show up for a meeting in Suzuki Roshi's cabin of the officers of the monastery. And he was head of the dining room, so he'd go. And one day, the director of the monastery said, when it came time for people to talk, the director of the monastery said, "Roshi, there's a student here who's staying up late at night and drinking alcohol with the guests. What should we do?" And Suzuki Roshi paused and cleared his throat and said, "Everybody's making their best effort." And then the director said, "But it's really outrageous. His behavior is really unacceptable. We have rules about not having alcohol, and he's doing it right in front of everybody. It's a really bad precedent." And Roshi said, "It's better that he does it in front of us than that he hides it from us." And then the director said, "But we need to do something. We can't just let this go." And Roshi said, "Sometimes someone's following the spirit of the rule, even though they're not following the letter of the rule." And then the director said, "Wouldn't it be better if you followed the letter of the rule too?" And Roshi said, "Yeah, that would be best." And David stayed. And, when I think about that, there's a lot of people who were better at following the rules than David. But Suzuki Roshi knew David's heart. And David is the one, after, all of that, who started the Suzuki Roshi archive and spent $50,000 of his own money because Zen Center wouldn't support him to do a Suzuki Roshi archive. Because Suzuki Roshi could see David's heart, and David loved him. So that kind of scene passed, all that to someone's good heart. And it's not without its... we don't know if it's quite the same, but, earlier in his life, Suzuki Roshi was asked by his teacher to take in a monk who was kind of crazy. And people told him, warned him, that monk is dangerous, that monk is crazy. And Suzuki Roshi felt he had to keep this monk, and because his teacher had asked him. And then one day, his children discovered that this monk had murdered his wife with an axe. So, we don't know. We don't know what, if you live only in the horizontal world, we have to defend ourselves, we have to get our guns, we have to keep these people, In the vertical world, we see each other's hearts, and sometimes we make mistakes, about how to take care of one another and how to, value what's precious. I heard a story in that regard about the Dalai Lama. And apparently the Dalai Lama tells this story sometimes when people are especially distraught about making bad decisions that are turn out to be costly. And apparently a man in his late 60s or early 70s came to the Dalai Lama and said, there are these exercises that younger, usually meant for younger people to do, and I'd like to do them, for my practice. What do you think? And the Dalai Lama said, they're not so good for you at your age. It'd be better, they're better for a younger person. And a week later, the man committed suicide. And he said, And apparently it was so he could come back as a you know, be reincarnated and have a new body to be able to do those practices. The Dalai Lama is like, oh. But anyway, that's Suzuki Rishi could see you and receive you. And it's pretty unusual. About it for the evening, huh? Oh, we've run over time, in fact. So much for cake. Okay.